In this 70th episode of the Misal Podcast, you will listen to my conversation with Saad Khawar, co-founder of Datacade, a provider of labeling and annotation solutions for large language models. Let's listen in. Welcome to the Misal Podcast. Saad, how are you?
I am doing absolutely great. Excited to be here, Zaid.
Excited to have you on and learn more about what you're building next. Let's get started with a quick introduction. Please tell me a little bit about yourself and what is the problem that you're trying to solve with Datacade?
Born and raised in Karachi, went to university at LUMS, majored in computer science. After I graduated, so I came back to Karachi and then went back to Lahore again to start something with a friend. We didn't know what we were going to start. At that time, we were absolutely clueless. We had no clue about anything, how anything works, unlike the kids these days, who are much, much more aware. Went back to Lahore, started, you could say, thinking about different ideas, having absolutely no clue about anything that goes on in the world. First, we thought about how about we build something that, and this was back in 2015, right? So Bitcoin was fairly recent, fairly new, especially in Pakistan. So we built something that will essentially be a democratized application installed in everyone's phone or computing, etc. And the unutilized processing power it will use to mine cryptocurrency and give the user something as well for their processing power, etc. Then we thought this wouldn't work because the incentive wouldn't be large enough and the risk is too high for anyone to download an application like that. So we said we'd go to the government to ask them no particular person in the government, just the government. We'll go to the government and ask them to introduce a processing tax, a tax on processing power through the PTA that whenever you log over to the internet from Pakistan, a 10% tax on processing power will be used to my cryptocurrency, essentially. We had no clue how energy worked. Another idea we had was, at that time, there didn't used to be a consolidated TSX. Used to be the Lahore Stock Exchange, Karachi Stock Exchange. Started thinking about if there are dual listings, a company that is listed on the Islamabad Stock Exchange or Lahore Stock Exchange, the KSE, if there are dual listings, they will inherently have to track the same way. So if something, let's say, rises in value in, let's say, Karachi, and it is still lagging behind in Lahore, that is when we will take position. We'll create an application that will do that. And then we found out that is not how anything works, right? So I think did a bit of back and forth between ideas, then finally started at Zameen.com. Did a bit of business development there, was miserable, left. And then a friend introduced me to Furkan Kidwai from Dubai. I think Dubai changed my life. It was one of the few indigenously founded companies at the time to have raised venture capital in. It was scaling or starting to scale like an early stage startup. And Furkan Kidwai, I consider a mentor to this day, right? So I learned an insane amount at Kidwai. We were fairly small, grew very quickly over the next two and a half years. I started there as a data scientist. For the first time, I saw a vast amount of data, user sessions. Everything was tracked. So everything was tracked. What user is coming onto the website, how many sessions happening in a day, what is the journey like, etc. So I got into the retention numbers and I went crazy, right? So I never had access to this amount. So started there as a data scientist, then eventually left the Y as the head of product. During that time, Furkan Kidwai was gracious enough to involve me in everything, right? So we would be sitting at 3 a.m. If, let's say, there was a VC due diligence, for example, we'd be preparing the P&L, etc. I was doing operations. I was on VC calls. I was leading the product, that goes without saying. So I think it was a brilliant learning experience. Even though I might have different leadership or management styles, etc., but I think he's one of the smartest people that the ecosystem had. Then I got in touch with Asad. Asad was thinking of building something, reached out to me, and we started thinking about how this, where I was previously, could be done in a much, much better way. Then started merging more just right before COVID. Over the next three and a half years, built a great team, we managed to gather around a great bunch of people to grow the business to north of $50 million in annualized revenue, raised $15 million in primarily venture capital, therefore a few family offices, a little bit of private equity, etc. The way that Medgen was scaled, I think it was a phenomenal experience. Whatever the outcome in the end, I think that was a brilliant learning experience, right? Getting towards the end of 2022, the global capital markets had already turned. Pakistan now was hit especially hard post the Khan fiasco. And we are getting into February 2023. We had a couple of term sheets, had a line of sight on the amount of capital that would have gotten through, at least probably to a bit of break even. You never know, but that was the hypothesis. But then the dollar went from 230 to 280 in a matter of, I would say, 7 to 8 days. And the VCs that weren't even responding in the first place to any emails started sending rejection. So those we were engaged with, I get rejection emails from. Those who haven't even replied to, who hadn't even replied to even one single email, just sent the rejection email back to them. So, I mean, it was brutal. And then we were still, of course, burning cash. Managed to pull together a term sheet, but it was, of course, contingent of us being able to raise a larger round, at least 60-65% of the capital still needed to be ready, which we were ultimately unsuccessful, and we decided to shut the business down, right? So, because it was a huge, huge infrastructure play. We were across three cities, had 28 stores doing B2C, and over three warehouses still. It was a large infrastructure. We couldn't sustain it without capital, given that we were still decided to shut the business down. Then basically, I started thinking about what I wanted to bring next. And here I am at datagate.ai.
This is the case with like almost 99% of the startups, which is that they run out of funding. And so you talked about certain things that a lot of startups were facing at the same time you were facing, which is like you needed money, but the country's environment, the turmoil, the political landscape was, you know, all over the place. A lot of different things are happening. Worldwide macro also taking place at the same time. So what would you say, like, what changed overnight in your point of view that made things difficult for you to extend that runway?
So I think we were caught at a bad time, right? We know global capital flows in VC have declined substantially by over half, right? That is primarily driven by a couple of things. One would be, let's say, very high interest rates relative to what they were 2-3 years ago. That is one. Two, I think all of the hedge funds, the crossovers, the large capital allocators not otherwise investing in private venture also started to look at this as a viable asset class. So they started to veer away. So capital started to flow more and more out of A, venture capital, and B, out of these markets with higher risk perception. Actually, not with higher risk perception, with higher risk, like Pakistan, for example. We, I think, were caught at a bad time. So we were towards the, I would say, approaching towards the end of our runway. We had a I would say, clear line of sight, at least at the amount of capital that would, or that might have gotten us to EBITDA break-even, which was our opinion at the time, or our hypothesis at the time, that this amount of capital is what we need to get to this point, etc. Then Pakistan was, I would say, hit especially hard. So that might have happened otherwise, you never know, right? So until money is in the bank, you never really know. We might have otherwise still not been able to raise, and it is easier to blame stuff on the political turmoil, etc. Or the rapid devaluation that happened over the course of, let's say, 2 weeks from 230 to 280, etc. You still never really know. We might not have been able to raise still. Yeah, I think we was, I would say, unable to do course correct very quickly, because if you have a operation of that size, it takes time to course correct. And then back of your mind, you're thinking about, if, let's say, I cut down this much cost because this is a very infrastructure-heavy business, my revenues are invariably going to go down. So how much hit on my top line I can take whilst remaining a viable, or let's say a viable investment option, right? Not just for new capital that we would have needed to raise, but for the existing investors that were already invested into the company. So I think you're stuck in two minds in a situation like this. And if you're not stuck in two minds, then still businesses like these, which have large infrastructures, take time to scale down. So I think during that scale down, which we had started to do by August 2022, I would say, it still took a lot of time, I would say. So I think that was in a nutshell what happened basically to mention more.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because there is like a black hole when it comes to why startups fail in Pakistan, and I am trying my best to get founders to talk about issues that happen.
Another thing, right? So just to your point, in hindsight, that, I mean, how you traditionally define venture, that wasn't traditional venture, right? So most of these businesses, the very infrastructure heavy 5-8% margin businesses, aren't traditional venture, right? So the front loaded investment into, let's say, capex, etc., is much larger than eventually the returns that you are going to be able. These might seem like businesses that are growing pretty quickly, are, let's say, doing $50, $60, $70 million, $100 million in top line. But these can prove to be value traps, right? Once you come in, and if these business do manage to survive, let's say, over the next 10, 12 years, you might not be able to ever see again the valuations that you came in at during the period when all of these startups were raising capital.
There's a lot of misconceptions out there about how easy this might have been for you, but I just don't see how this thing was easy, because not only are you talking about warehouses, like you're talking about something that's heavily regulated. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't that easy to do all the things that you did to scale. But before moving on, like, I also want to ask you about what kind of mental or psychological toll did this take? Because when you scale something, you like give your heart out to it, and then eventually it like a lot comes crashing down. So like, did you like go through a phase where, like, I'm just trying to figure out how you coped with the whole situation and then bounced back and started a new startup, and now you're building something new. Like, what was that like?
So I think it was easily the, I wouldn't say worst, it was a learning experience and insight, but it was one of the most mentally taxing 4 or 5 months, I would say, of my entire life. It wouldn't be wrong if I said. I couldn't really sleep. I think Asit couldn't sleep. CFO couldn't sleep. So a lot of the people that were in the know and had put their hearts into building the company and scaling it at peak 2,000 direct and indirect colleagues, because that also takes a toll, right? All of these people that you hired have families. They aren't going to understand why you're letting them go, why the business is shutting down. And then the horror stories start coming in. People come to you, let's say, wife has this operation on, or my kid is going to be kicked out of school tomorrow if I don't pay the fees, etc. So it all just becomes a nightmare. It becomes very mentally taxing, I think. It isn't an easy experience, especially once you've gotten to a scale and where you have all of these people around. So in I think a lot of other stuff doesn't hurt as much as letting go of the people does, right? And at that scale, because these aren't performance-based layoffs. These people are losing their jobs by no fault of their own. So I think it is pretty mentally taxing. But you probably eventually recover at some point.
I can't imagine what you have gone through, but would have gone through. But like, you know, I think you bounced back pretty well. And like, I would love to learn more about, like you mentioned that there were some learnings within medicine more that might have led you to building what you're building now. So can you talk a little about what you are building now and how medicine more might have, you know, helped you?
DataKey.ai is a managed marketplace for AI companies to be able to get quality annotated training data. Assume that you are an AI company building a co-pilot for fund managers investing in public equities, right? You want to choose a stock. You ask your AI co-pilot to give you 10, let's say, securities that are in the SaaS index on NASDAQ that you can invest in tomorrow or that you should invest in tomorrow and hit on a very, let's say, solid rationale and very, very logical grounding gives you those 10 securities that you can invest in. Any AI application, so I'll first talk about how an AI application is structured, right? Any AI application that you come in contact with has three fundamental pillars. One is the compute infrastructure underlying AI. The second is the model itself, so the model architecture on the, let's say, code that has been parameterized, etc. And the third is high quality annotated training data that you need for your model to be able to learn. And then there is quite a bit of reinforcement learning that eventually makes the model better and better, right? So two of these things have largely been commoditized. So compute infrastructure, you can go to AWS, you can go to Azure, for example, and get all the compute that you need and at a click of a button, and that too at a pay-as-you-use model. You can build most AI applications by taking open source pieces of code. You can use PyTorch, etc., and get an AI application up and running in most cases. Generally. The two are becoming more and more commoditized. The third, however, how do you get access to high quality training data? Because most of it at this stage needs to be, let's say, human generated. If the system were able to generate training data to be able to train itself, we would have already reached AGI, right? But we're not there yet. So that this is this now becomes the limiting factor for AI development primarily, because infrastructure is going to get more and more cheaper as time passes, compute is going to get more and more efficient, the models are becoming more and more larger, they have become much larger than you used to be, let's say 20 years ago. And as models get larger and larger, they need, because they now have billions upon billions of, let's say, parameters, right? And they need trillions of data points to be able to train that. So this is the space now we are building in. And I dive a bit deeper into that, but I'll tell you how Medicine More helped in getting there, right? Medicine More taught us a couple of things. So one was Pakistan has very low consumption, and consumption is abysmally low for non-essential items. Just to put things in perspective, 25% of your per capita income, of an average Pakistani's per capita income, goes towards food. That in India is 11%, in the US is 67%. So if you are spending 1/4 of your income just to make ends meet, the consumption is invariably going to be very low, right? You can build a materially significant business in Pakistan, but if you want to build something substantial, not in 10, 15, 20 years time, today, over the next 5 years, you need to be building for the global markets, right? This was started with a global thesis. So there were four fundamental tenets that I started to think about after Medicine More shut down, what I wanted to do next. This was first, that it needed to have a global thesis. We needed to be able to add global value. The second was because we are not selling in, let's say, developing frontier markets. We are selling in the developed market, right? And our supply markets are not going to be just, let's say, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Egypt, etc. Countries that we say have high, let's say, cognition to income ratios. So, let's say, a chartered accountant, or let's say a CFA compared like to like with the US, a CFA would be making, let's say, at JP or Goldman with 3 years of experience, roughly around $150,000 a year. In Pakistan, they would be making roughly around $10,000 a year. So, there is a high gap between even the people that we would perceive as higher cognition than most in these markets. One was we needed to add global value. The second was, because we come from frontier markets and have that experience, we wanted to meaningfully impact the lives of people in the frontier markets, right? Just take Pakistan, for example. There is high youth unemployment. Unemployment is 3 times higher in graduates, right? 400,000 people graduate from universities, ballpark, every year in Pakistan. And we are just graduating people into an economy that isn't ready to absorb them with degrees that don't, let's say, have work for the people that are coming into the economy. But these people have moderate to high level of cognition, right? This is another core thesis. Take females, for example, right? So roughly 25% of all females in Pakistan with the university degree are part of the labor force. Why are the rest at home? Or even if they are at home, can they not generate incremental income whilst being at home? So this was the second fundamental tenet that we were basing the business around. We wanted to add meaningful impact into the lives of people in the frontier markets. And this should serve at scale as a way to increase the overall income level of the checker. The third was we wanted to, and this was a very harsh, I would say, sort of a learning that we got from it. And now I think I've become a bit more averse to this. The third was we wanted to shield ourselves from the macros, not just the currency risks, but reduced capital flows, political instability, etc. That was the third. I mean, we can't be playing, let's say, a cat and mouse chase with the dollar every time we grow by 50%, the dollar devalues by, let's say, 50%, and it just never ends. The second is it is very cyclical. It is the economy in frontier markets have shorter cycles compared to more developed markets. So you constantly run the risk of the inflation is going to run high in a couple of years, and then you will have reduced demand, etc. And so we wanted to shield ourselves from the micro risks associated with the frontier markets, yet we'll be building out of here. That was the third. And fourth, we wanted to be building for the future. We wanted to be in a space that will redefine how the world works. So in the next 20 to 25 years, 50%, half of the jobs that exist currently in the way that they exist won't be there. So they will have, let's say, augmented. There will be something new in their stead, but in the way they exist today. So it is going to be a wildly different world. So we wanted to be building for a space that is going to be the future, essentially. Keeping all of these things in mind and keeping the I would say, founder business fit sort of a perspective in mind, because myself and my co-founder, who I'll talk about later, we're both tech-enabled operational founders, with my core expertise being in, let's say, product and ops, etc. I think this made the most sense, because it is currently a $13 billion market, it, as of 2022, going to $57-58 billion by 2030, growing at 21-22%. Year over year. So I think this made the most sense as a space to be building in.
There are not that many AI startups that I'm aware of. When I was looking around, like, I don't think I found anything other than what you're building. So this is really great. But yeah, do tell me about your co-founder and what exactly is his role and how big is your team?
So just to clarify one thing, we are not an AI company. We are helping AI companies build better quality model by better quality models by getting them access to high quality training data. So we are not an AI company. We may have, across the data pipeline, some AI processes to improve the quality and improve task distribution, etc. We ourselves are in the business of, let's say, supplying picks and shovels in the gold rush.
I was about to say that, picks and shovels. Yes.
So my co-founder was 1 year my junior at Lums. So he started at Green post Lums, and then was the first global employee at Civil. Eventually left the company as a VP of enterprise business, Shazib. I started thinking about the idea then Shazib and I, we keep in touch, right? So I started discussing this with Shazib. Then when I was, I would say, ready to launch, I flew into Dubai to convince him fully and bring him to Pakistan. So he is based out of Dubai, but he's moved to Pakistan for the foreseeable future, for at least the time up until the time that the operations are completely set up here. So the team is fairly small. We are a team of 5 people, apart from the people on the marketplace, of course, but they're separate. But we are a team of 5 people, including the 2 of us. We started operations towards the end of November, and December was our first full month. So this is our 4th month in operations, and I think the early traction has been phenomenal, I would say. There is an insane amount of demand. And I'll dive a bit deeper into what it is exactly that we are solving for and why AI companies need that, right? If you have any questions before that, please feel free.
No, feel free to tell me a little bit more about what the problem is and what are the customer pain points that you're solving for.
Say you're an AI company. Let's just say you're a Tesla. You need 10 million images annotated. Why do you need 10 million images annotated? Because you eventually want your vehicle to drive autonomously, right? And you don't want it to kill people. Now, how do you tell the system, let's say, what a person is? You need to be able to teach it that, right? And you need, if the system already knew what a person is, you wouldn't need to teach it, right? So you need a human to teach AI systems what stuff is, so it is able to, it can start forming relationships with you. So say you're a Tesla, you send out 10 million images, we distribute it onto our marketplace, depending upon which person on the marketplace is best suited for that sort of work, we give it to them, let's say, in a month, 2 months, 3 months time, for example. There are companies building in this space. The largest one is Scale.ai, valued at, I think, $7.5 billion. The start of 2021, they closed 2020 at $100 million in revenue, grew that to $750 million by 2023. So they have been massively growing. If you are an AI company, if you're, let's say, a smaller AI company, let's say, Series A, Series B startup, there are no really good options for you. You can't go to Scale.ai because they don't, or they won't even get on a call with you, for example. If you don't commit to $1 million in revenue, at least over the course of the year. And most other companies doing this have high revenue minimums because they don't operate on a marketplace model. Scale does, but Scale is, most other companies have just large buildings with people sitting in there and just annotating data on different sorts of tasks. So they, A, can't really scale their operations. B, they need to have revenue minimums. They need to lock you in for at least 6 to 12 months because they will need to hire a lot of people for your work. They can't just scale down and up at the click of a button. So at relatively early to mid-stage startups who don't have such high training data requirements wouldn't want to be, let's say, locked in or won't commit to or wouldn't want to commit to high amount of revenue minimum, right? That is one. Two, they can't hire people in-house because that is a high management burden. Most of them are building in the Bay Area with teams of 25, 30, 60, 80 people. They can't just hire 100, let's say, annotators to manage them because it becomes a constant operation. You can go to these, let's say, open freelance platforms like Upwork, for example, but you'll have to, let's say, hunt down, interview hundreds upon hundreds of people and then get to, let's say, the 40, 50 that you need. And you have to negotiate payment terms with them separately, etc. You have to manage all of them separately, assign work to them separately. And the most important part, as is with any, let's say, annotation operation, is quality. 3 things I would say are fundamental to any AI company's data training requirements. One would be, you need to deliver quality. Second, because this work is done in volume, you need to be able to do it at much, much lower cost. The third would be the speed of deployment of the AI models need to be quicker. So they can retrain, reiterate, etc., and continually improve their models, for which they need you to be quick. They can't have, let's say, 3 months, 8 months, 10 months in lead times if they are, let's say, smaller organization, because over the next 12 to 18 months, they are going to have to raise the next round of funding, and that is going to be off of certain benchmarks that their model is going to achieve, because for a long, long time, they are not going to be generating revenue. Even if they are going to be generating revenue, it's not going to. If you're an AI company, you have very few good options, especially if you are an early stage AI company. You can't hire people in-house. You will have difficulty outsourcing the work because you will be trapped in high revenue minimums. You will need to commit to high revenues, except you can't, let's say, outsource it on some open freelance platform because you will have to compromise on quality because there is no system in place. So this is essentially what we saw as a problem and what we are now looking to solve. We started reaching out to customers, just cold reach outs or some intros through connections here and there. And I think there is a key pain point there, right? We are working with one company that is backed by Andreessen. We are in the process of signing another company, which is Lightspeed and BCG backed. We are in advanced conversations in a company that is Khosla backed, etc. So, and we are very early with no track record. Of all the places in the world, why us for those companies, right? There must be a pain point. There must be a problem that they won't be able to, right? So this is the underlying thesis that we based the business on. And this is what we are essentially looking to solve.
What exactly is the plan with DataKade? Are you going to be raising money and, you know, scaling that way? Or this time you're just going to bootstrap and then see how it goes?
In terms of DataKade, I think the sort of industry we are in is evolving at a very, very rapid pace, right? And we need to be able to adapt with the times, and we need to, I think, grow quickly if we are to keep pace with this industry. I think we raised a small angel round earlier on, and we are going to be raising probably a small venture round in the next couple of months, hopefully. I think for a business like this, there are three fundamental things, right? We are already running into challenges that we thought we would face later right now because of the lack of a robust technology infrastructure, let's say, productized marketplace that we can distribute the work on. We feel that when we limit our ability to grow more and more. So we need to build a solid, robust technology infrastructure. That is one. Two, I think we need to ramp up our sales efforts, because once you get in with a customer and you deliver a high amount of quality, I think it is unlikely that the customer will churn. Or even if they do churn because they don't, let's say, have a specific annotation requirement at the moment, whenever they come back, they'll come back to you, right? And there is a mushroom growth of AI companies in the Bay Area right now, and you need to get in with as many of them as you possibly can. And the second is we want to ramp up our sales efforts. And the third is we need to get data compliance. A lot of the works that we are currently targeting is on publicly available data that companies need annotated. But as we grow larger and larger, I think we will run into the challenge of not having, let's say, the data certification that we would need to, let's say, wrangle with or tackle proprietary data that enterprises send our way. So that would be the third thing that we need to be spending on. So we will be looking to raise, I think, a small amount over the next couple of months, hopefully. But this is an inherently different business to what we are used to building, or what we have gotten used to building, because this is a much, much higher gross margin business, a very high contribution margin business. It can scale, right? So currently we have a couple of dozen annotators that are working with us. So we just, a lot of it is manual. We send work their way. We have our quality checks in the middle. Most of them, women sitting at homes, working remotely on these sorts of tasks that we send their way. So I think if we are able to scale this, we are not only going to be helping AI companies and learning a lot along the way, but we are going to be able to meaningfully impact the lives of people here in the frontier markets, basically.
That's awesome. I mean, yeah, I mean, for you, it's like a completely different thing because you went from like B2C sort of model to B2B now, and B2B is a completely different ballgame. A lot of sales meetings and a lot of, you know, larger contracts. So I have had a really great time talking to you. This has been a very, very interesting conversation. Thanks for being so transparent. I wish you best of luck with DataKit.
Thank you so much, Dayat. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.